This episode of All About the Gear is brought to you by BorrowLenses.com, who also provided the equipment we're reviewing today. Hi there, this is Doug Kay, and welcome to another episode of All About the Gear. You may notice something different right out of the chute, and that is that I am not Frederick Van Johnson. In fact, Frederick Van Johnson is not even here today. At the end of the last episode, when we talked about my experiences shooting film, we hinted that there might be a change in the show. And Frederick and I have been sitting down and scratching our heads and figuring out after 2 years, how can we improve the show? And one of the things that we found ourselves often doing in the show is referring to Gordon Lang over at CameraLabs.com. And the reason for that is that Gordon is sort of the ultimate camera reviewer. If you've ever read his reviews, you know that he goes into incredible depth with a lot of sample images, analysis, a great deal of detail. And we were constantly referring over to CameraLabs.com as, if you wanted more information, go listen to Gordon. So we said, well, why don't we turn the show around? Why don't we invite Gordon to join us? So what I'd like to do is introduce you to the man himself, Mr. Gordon Lang. Say hi, Gordon.
Hi, Doug. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. And the plan is that this is the new All About the Gear show going forward. And rather than Frederick playing nodding dummy to me, I'm going to play nodding dummy to Gordon because you know, Gordon, your site is the one that I would always go to when I had a technical issue, or I'd email you and I'd say, Gordon, I'm scratching my head over this. What can you tell me? So welcome to All About the Gear.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be part of the show.
Okay, so we're going to kick this off with a camera that I was going to review. I actually got my hands on it, and Gordon did just one of his marvelous reviews, and that is the Olympus OMD EM5 Mark II. So, Gordon, why don't you tell us a little bit about this camera and just sort of kick it off.
Okay, this the OMD EM5 Mark II is second to the top of the range in Olympus's mirrorless camera lineup. It's still behind the OMD EM1, which I have here, and throughout the show we're going to be making a lot of comparisons between these models, and also the original EM5, which I have here. So we've got a lot of cameras to compare. In many respects, the EM5 Mark II is actually superior to the EM1. So this is going to be a very interesting discussion because we can go into a bit more detail about which one's going to be better for you to buy. Personally speaking, straight off the bat, I really, really love the EM5 Mark II. I was a big fan of the original EM5 and of the EM1, which is the camera I use for most of my day-to-day shooting. So I'm very excited to tell you guys all about it.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to do the conversion from pounds to dollars, just to give our U.S. audience a clue. The Mark II costs about $1,100 U.S. You can spend another $900 and get it with the Zuiko 12-40 f/2.8 Pro lens, and we'll talk about that. That lens cost $1,000 on its own. So if you want the high-end kit lens, you're looking at almost $2,000 in U.S. terms. You can get it in all black like this or with silver trim.
It's £899 in the U.K. body alone. And depending on what region you're in, you can get different kit options. As you mentioned, there's the 12-40 2.8. That's a really high-end pro lens. But some regions will also offer it with the 12-50, which is a cheaper kit zoom. So there's a variety of different options available.
Very good. So talk to us about the body and the controls on this thing, because they've made some changes to it.
Yeah, well,
I should explain to everybody that at the moment, because we're just getting started with Gordon doing the show, we have Gordon, although he has a camera, you have a camera there, right?
Yeah, not the Mark II. I've got the Mark I and okay. The OMD EM1. So between us, we've got
I have the Mark II here, which I have actually not used. I got it from BorrowLenses.com. Thanks, BorrowLenses. And I've taken it out of the box, and we're using it as a prop today. So as Gordon, this is going to be interesting, surgery by remote control. As Gordon describes various things, I will do my best to point them out.
Okay, well, at first glance, the cameras look very, very similar to each other. Olympus really, for me, nailed the retro-modern combination. There's a fashion for retro-looking cameras, but there's a reason that cameras changed, that controls changed, and really, without getting nostalgic, they changed for a reason. They now have superior controls, but a lot of us hark back to the design of older cameras. So it's a very difficult balance to get right. And for me, Olympus really nailed it with the original EM5 Mark I, which if you're watching the video I'm holding now, it's a very compact camera, but it uses a lot of design cues from the OM 35mm bodies. It's just feels really good in your hands. But the interesting thing is when they released the OMD EM1, the quality was essentially the same. Stabilization was a bit better, but the really big difference was the size and the shape of the camera and the controls. And what Olympus did was fitted basically not just a chunkier grip, but also chunkier buttons, chunkier control dials, chunkier mode dial, chunkier on-off switch, chunkier everything. And it's surprising how much difference that's made. A lot of people go, oh, small cameras, they're not going to feel good in my hands. You know, I'm a big person. I mean, I'm not a big person. I don't have huge hands, but I know people with big hands. And they keep going on about how they like their big DSLRs and how they couldn't handle a mirrorless. But I give them something like an EM1, and they're like, ooh, small body, but very comfortable to hold. So moving on to the Mark II, the EM5 Mark II, the first thing you'll notice if you're comparing it directly against the original is Olympus has beefed up the controls. The two control dials on the top by your thumb and your index finger, Doug, you'll notice how easily they fall beneath those fingers right now. But if I show you, if you switch over to my feed, you will see the position of the dials on the original on the top of the body here. So you can see that not only are they bigger on the new one, they're taller, they're chunkier, but they've changed position and they're much easier to turn. Now, you might think, oh, come on, tell us about the 40 megapixel mode, tell us about the stabilization, but it's little things like this that make or break a camera for me in day-to-day use. The bottom line is the EM1 feels much better than the original EM5, and now the EM5 Mark II, even though it is a little camera, feels a lot better than the original EM5. Just those two control dials made a big difference. Even the mode dial is chunkier, the on-off switch is chunkier. Everything is kind of more tactile. And you'll also notice a slight change in the front grip, which gives you just a little bit more to wrap your fingers around on the new Mark II. Very little adjustments in ergonomics, but ones that make a very big difference in practice. To me, the EM5 Mark II is a much more comfortable an easy camera to hold and use.
Okay, so I want to ask you about that because, again, I haven't shot with it, but here I am with a sort of an intermediate lens, the 14 to 150 variable f-stop, variable aperture. The grip for me, I don't know, do I have big hands? I don't know, but the grip for me is too small. I'm getting a cramp just trying to hold this. Even with this not very large zoom, I need to cushion it underneath.
And can you turn it around, Doug, and show us where your little finger is? Is your little finger dangling? Is it touching?
My little finger is you know, sort of at the very bottom edge there.
Now, can you switch over to my feed for a moment?
Yeah.
So what I'm doing now is holding up the OMD.
I thought I could. There we go.
I'm holding up the OMD EM1, and you'll see there my little finger is not dangling. It is just about perched on the edge of the grip here because the EM1 is a taller camera with a bigger grip. So your little finger isn't left dangling, but Olympus has got a very neat solution for the EM5. They actually had it on the original EM5, so if you're familiar with that camera, you'll know what they did. They have a battery grip, which makes it taller and chunkier, but the clever thing about it, it comes in two halves, and you can buy the first half, just kind of boosts the height of the camera and the size of the grip a bit. It doesn't let you fit another battery, it just kind of makes it a bit chunkier, and that makes it much more comfortable to hold. Your little finger isn't left dangling, and cleverly, on the Mark II, it now adds a headphone jack, which is great if you want to monitor audio if you're doing movies. And then if you want the extra power, you bolt on the next part of the grip underneath, which contains the extra battery. So it's a very clever technique that they've done. I've seen some other manufacturers do so. Fujifilm does something similar as well. They do kind of mini grips. Some of them have got Arca Swiss type plates on. Olympus don't do that. But there's quite a neat way you can make the camera more comfortable. I'm looking wistfully off camera here at the original EM5 because even though I was originally supplied it with the grip, and even though it is more comfortable with the grip, I prefer shooting without the grip. It's slightly obtuse thing to say, but I just really like the compact nature of it without the grip.
Isn't there something a little perverse about working so hard to make a camera that's as small as possible and then saying, you know, it's really great, it's a tiny camera, but now you have to spend a little extra money to make it large enough to feel good? it's just sort of an odd thing, but that's okay.
Well, at least they give you the option, you know. I mean, a lot of cameras, if they do even offer the option of a battery grip, that's it. You either have the normal camera or you make it about an inch and a half taller with the battery grip. At least what Olympus are doing is giving you a two-part solution. So if you just want, if you look at it and you think, if only it was a little bit bigger, then you can make it a little bit bigger.
Right.
But if you make it really big, you can make it really big. But for me, I think it loses a bit of the charm when you've got the grip attached to it. I prefer it in its naked state, as the engineers intended.
So this camera, Olympus now refers to as freeze-proof. Did they actually change anything from the previous version?
No, they just didn't test it. So the way, as I understand it, is they didn't test for freeze-proofing when they did the EM5 Mark I. And they did with the EM1. So they said the EM1 is now freeze-proof as well as being water and weather resistant. You can't put it underwater, but you can splash it quite considerably. It is quite happy in the rain. Obviously, you should have a weatherproof lens attached at the same time, because that's a point of failure if you don't. But they have tested it on the M5 Mark II, so they can now officially say that it is freeze-proof as well as weatherproof.
Right.
So it's small, but it's, you know, it's a pretty tough camera. You know, you can use it in some demanding conditions. And the other thing you'll notice while you're looking at the front of the camera there is on the top right of the picture, you'll see it's got a PC sync port for connecting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that wasn't on the original. That was something that they put on the EM1, which is for connecting to external lighting. It's very useful if you do a lot of studio photography. But they found room for it on the EM5 Mark II. Also, interestingly, if you have a look at the back of the EM5 Mark II, can you show us the back of it?
Yeah.
You'll see by the viewfinder. You'll see by the viewfinder that there is a to the right of the viewfinder, there's a switch. Now, this is very clever. There are two dials on the top of this camera, same as the EM1, okay. Same as a lot of enthusiast cameras.
Switch back to the right camera here. Okay.
Yeah. Now, typically, let's say you're an aperture priority. One of those dials will adjust the aperture and the other one will adjust the exposure compensation, as you would expect. However, what Olympus lets you do is assign different functions to effectively the number two position on the switch. So you switched it to number two. Well, now it's on number one. If you switch it to number two, you could now have one dial operating the ISO and the other one operating the white balance. And in true Olympus style, this camera is so ridiculously customizable. You can make any button and any control dial do anything you want. So this is a really neat way of making two dials effectively at like four. And because they've thought very carefully about where the controls are, this is something that you can flick with your thumb very easily when you're looking through the viewfinder and suddenly have these two other features at your disposal.
Yep.
So it's really nice to be able to do that. You also notice an HDR button on the top. Now, that's new to the Mark II, which directly lets you access the HDR mode in the camera.
A little out of focus at the moment here. But, yes, I was surprised to see an HDR button. I didn't think that HDR was that big a deal that people would want a button. But, of course, these buttons aren't hard casting concrete in terms of their function, are they?
Yeah, you can customize anything. In fact, that's kind of one of the pros and one of the cons of the Olympus system. The first time you have a look at the custom menus on one of these cameras, it's quite overwhelming. I mean, there's tens and tens of different functions available, loads and loads of things. You can change just about everything on it. At the same time, you can use the camera very successfully without ever touching the custom menu. So if you go in there and you're like, whoa, what's going on? It's like the first time you open Adobe Photoshop. It's a very steep learning curve. You're like, what is going on here? Look at all these buttons, all these icons. But if you do think, you know what? I wish that button did that. Or I wish that the dial worked the other way around. Well, guess what? There is almost certainly a custom function to change it.
Right. So while we're looking at the camera, in fact, let me go back to the camera for those who are watching the video so you can see it. This camera has a rear LCD that is fully articulating.
This is a very important upgrade for me, anyway.
Which means if I turn it on, you might be able to see something out of there. I'm not sure. But you can swing it out, which is obviously great for video. You can tip it up so that if you want to shoot looking down, if you want to shoot looking up, you can tip it this way, and it swings various ways. The one thing that's interesting about it, though, is I find with these kinds of things, as much as I like them, if I'm in still mode, And let's say I'm sitting here. Let me show you the right way here. I'm in still mode and I've got my rear LCD working. That pretend that's actually showing you something. And I now want to go below my waist. I want to shoot looking down into the camera like an old twin lens camera. I can't just flip it up. I have to actually swing it out to
That is a really interesting observation. I hadn't thought of that. Do you want to? Do you want me to show you how it looks on the EM1? Do you want to switch over to my camera? So can you see? So this is the EM1, and if I want to shoot at waist height, I just tilt it like that, which is what you've just described. And that was just one motion. Or, of course, if I'm shooting high. Now, I've got a little tripod plate on at the moment, so I can't tilt it all the way back. But you can see I can angle it down if I'm shooting at high angles.
Right.
Now, this is great, and you've made a very good point there that I hadn't thought about, which is this is just a single motion, whereas when you want to do that on the Mark II, it's actually a two-part process. But the reason I prefer the EM5 Mark II to the EM1, and I should point out at this point that these vertically tilting screens have become almost the default now. Very few people do the fully articulated ones that you're showing on the Mark II. Panasonic are one of the few, and then only on their really high models. The problem with this is great for shooting at high or low angles when you're shooting in the landscape orientation. So that's with the camera held like this. Now, the thing is I actually really like shooting with a camera in the portrait or the tall orientation like this. And if you look at this now, the screen is now angled, is pointing to the side. So that's not going to help me at all if I want to compose in this shape, in this orientation, at high or low angles. And that is actually one of the beauties of the Micro Four Thirds system. When I ever mention this to people, they go, why do you always shoot in the portrait aspect ratio? You should shoot in landscape. And I'm like, well, yeah, but that's because you're shooting with a camera that shoots natively in the 3x2 shape, which is quite wide. Like Sony's, Canon's, Nikon's, almost everybody else, they have quite a wide shape image. And when you turn that on its side, it looks a bit extreme. Micro Four Thirds native shape is 4x3. And when you turn that on its side, it's not as extreme. It's a bit like the classic 10x8 inch print shape. And for me, it works very successfully in that shape. So the thing I really like about the OMD EM5 Mark II is that I can shoot with the camera held in the portrait orientation and articulate the screen out so that I can still compose comfortably at high or low angles. So for me personally, that's a really big upgrade and a reason that I would really want it.
And we should also point out, I think that, at least in my experience, that when you shoot video, it's for some reason, I don't know why, it's much nicer to be able to swing that screen out than it is to just look at it on the back. It just works much better. And of course, I think on this camera, you can flip it around so you can face it forward. So you can actually shoot it in a, you can be doing an interview or shooting a selfie, and you can actually see it from the front of the camera.
Now, of course, it is possible with some vertically tilting screens that they tilt all the way back to face yourself. There's a lot of selfie-oriented cameras that do that now. But unfortunately, the original EM5 and the EM1 cannot do that. They can only angle up to 90 degrees, not by 180. So you're right. If you're doing not just selfies, but pieces to camera, a lot of people doing video blogging these days, and it's really nice to have that screen facing you when you're talking to the camera. And you know that it's recording. There's nothing worse than filming a segment and then go run back down the camera and you press play and nothing was there because you forgot to put the you forgot to press the button. So that's a nice feature. In fact, Olympus, if you wanted, do you want to seg onto video?
Hang on a second. What? So the video?
Yeah. We could use that as a segue into video, because video has always been something that Olympus has not been a leader in, and it's maybe slightly embarrassing because Panasonic, which is their Micro Four Thirds partner, is of course outstanding at video. Cameras like the GH4 absolutely pioneering the way for 4K, for example, which is also a very nice camera if you're really into video.
So this camera doesn't do 4K, does it?
It does not do 4K. Now, at first, I thought that was a heating issue. 4K generates a lot of heat, so you need to get the heat out of the camera. That's one of the reasons that the Sony A7S cannot record 4K internally. If you want to record 4K on the A7S, you need to connect an external recorder. The GH4 is very unusual in that you can record 4K internally. Now, Olympus has its own heat problems because it has built-in stabilization. The sensor is on a platform that moves around to counteract camera shake. Benefit of doing it in cameras, it works with any lens you attach, and we're going to definitely talk a lot more about that later on because they've made some big changes. Mm-hmm. But for video, they just previously, whenever I look to the side, I'm looking at my EM1 and EM5 here, they previously could only shoot at 30p, and you couldn't, they did have focus peaking, but it wasn't available when you were recording. Bit rates were low. The stabilizer, even the built-in stabilization, didn't work properly for video, and they've changed all of that at the EM5 Mark II. They've made a lot of efforts here. You can now shoot, and it doesn't matter whether you buy it in North America or Europe or Asia. Every EM5 Mark II can shoot 24, 25, 30, 50, or 60p in 1080. I didn't tell you the reason it can't do 4K. My suspicion initially was that built-in stabilization, which generates quite a lot of heat, the combination of built-in stabilization and 4K may be too much to overcome on a body that size. I've asked Olympus many times. They actually implied to me that that was not a problem. Maybe it is actually the bandwidth in the processor, because you're talking about a lot of data. So they're not ruling out the possibility of doing 4K in camera with stabilization. It's just that this camera doesn't do it.
It's going to be interesting to see with the camera that I'm waiting for. I'm a Sony user, so I have a Sony A7S, which I love, but it has the 4K video, but it doesn't have Sony's new image stabilization that they have in the A7 Mark II. So I'm wondering if they'll have the same problem when they try and combine 4K and image stabilization in the body. Will there be an A7 Mark II? We'll have to wait and see.
Exactly. And that's something that we're watching very closely.
Yeah. The EM1 and the original EM5 both had very good image stabilization. I think the EM1 may have been slightly better, but what have they done here? Is it the same, or have they really done something to the image stabilization on this camera?
Well, it's still five axis, and what they've done is they've improved the actual mechanism, the motors, the driving system behind it, to achieve five stops of stabilization under SEPA conditions. Now, the EM1 achieved four stops, and to me was very effective. I'm going to stop right there and just say, of course, the real major benefit of having it built into the body is that it works with any lens you attach, whether it's a brand new dedicated Micro Four Thirds lens, an older Four Thirds lens from their old DSLR system, or even an adapted manual lens that's 50 years old. They can all be stabilized. And it also means that you don't have any moving elements within the lens. At least you don't need to have moving elements within the lens. Obviously, if you get a Panasonic Micro Four Thirds lens that has optical stabilization, then you can choose. The camera has a menu that says which stabilization system do you want to use. And you do need to choose, because if you have them both going at the same time, they can counteract each other. But in my experience, the built-in stabilization works really well. I wondered whether the EM5 Mark II could actually be better, and it actually is better than the EM1. The EM1, the image floats very, very steadily, but the EM5, it's eerie how steadily it floats. It just is absolutely rock steady. So I started having a bit of fun with this. I thought, okay, what can you handhold with this? So I used the 12 to 40 millimeter zoom at 12 millimeters. So this is a 24 millimeter equivalent field of view if you're comparing it to full frame. With Micro Four Thirds, there is a 2x field reduction factor. So everything is times 2. 12 becomes 24. Now, according to that old rule, 24 millimeter without stabilization would require a shutter speed of a 24th of a second. Okay, with one stop of stabilization, that would become a 12th. With two stops, it would become a 6th. With three stops, it would become a 3rd. With four stops, it would be anyway, you do the math. You do the math. Here's the important thing. At 12 millimeter, 24 mil equivalent, I found on the EM1, I could actually handhold exposures of half a second, which is pretty amazing considering the amount of coffee I drink and how much my hands shake. With the EM5 Mark II, I could easily, not occasionally, but easily handhold exposures of 1 second. If I was careful with my technique, if I held the camera very steady, took a breath and started breathing out as I pressed the button, then I actually managed to get sharp images at 2 seconds. And if you don't believe me, I've got them posted on my review at cameralabs.com, and you can download the originals. It's unbelievable, because what this camera now lets you do, more so than its predecessor, is shoot at night, or at least during the blue hour, handheld at low ISOs. Now, previously, if you're shooting at night or in, you know, dusky conditions, you would either need to do a trade-off, either with convenience and you have to shoot with a tripod if you want a nice low ISO for decent quality, or if you wanted to shoot handheld, you had to accept you had to shoot at 400, 800, 600, 1600 ISO or whatever. Now, I'm able to shoot at 200 ISO, which is the base sensitivity of these cameras, to the lowest ISO, in dusky conditions, handheld, with 1 or 2 second exposures with a wide-angle lens, and get amazingly clean results. It's hilarious. I was in St. Paul's Cathedral in London, which is obviously a very famous building, famously doesn't let you take pictures inside, but just recently they held an event where they let people take pictures in. They ticketed 300 photographers in there. I was one of them. I managed to get a ticket for that. And we're all taking pictures. And of course, it was, you know, it was about 7 o'clock at night. Light levels were getting low. It's a cathedral. It's quite dim inside. Everyone had tripods. I had a tripod, even though I had the EM1, let alone the EM5 Mark II. But I started doing a lot of handheld shots with it, and the looks of disdain I was getting from serious photographers with their big tripods, they were going, one man with a Nikon D810 and a massive tripod came over to me, and he looked, and you saw him, his face dropped when he saw I was using an Olympus. He was like, he said, you know, you should really be using -1 EV compensation, you know, it won't look right. And I said, well, you know, the metering's actually better on this camera than on yours. Yours consistently overexposes. And that's why you need to dial in -1 EV. But the fact I wasn't using a tripod, he hated that. And I was also recently in Ghent in Belgium, which is an amazing city, especially in the blue hour. Everyone is out, again, with tripods. And I was shooting handheld. I recently posted a photo on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram where I took a picture with the EM1 handheld over a river. So I'm holding it over the water, I'm dangling over it, wobbling like nobody's business, and I did a half second exposure with loads of reflections on it, and it looks fine. And to me, this has really transformed how I take pictures. Compact system cameras changed it for starters, because they were so small and light compared to a big DSLR. You didn't need to carry a big tripod anymore. You could travel lighter with smaller accessories. But now I'm getting to the point where I rarely need to use my tripod unless I'm doing neutral density filtered long exposure photography. You know, if you're doing 30 seconds, 60 seconds or 4 minutes, whatever, yes, you need a tripod. Of course you need a tripod. But for an awful lot of unfiltered photography, 1 second is more than enough. And that is achievable with the EM5 Mark II. It's utterly unbelievable, and it now works in the video as well. You can not just walk with the camera handheld while filming, but you can run with it. I've got, again, video clips of me doing that at CameraLabs.com, and the stabilization looks fantastic. So don't take a Steadicam with you, you know, one of these expensive stabilization devices. Just use a camera with really good stabilization. I think it's utterly remarkable, and that, for me, with the articulated screen, is a very, very important upgrade on this camera.
Yeah, I want to couple of things about that. First of all, when I've used the original cameras, the M1 and the M5, I've commented the image stabilization is absolutely spooky. It's so good, and there's even this thing I call stabilization lag, where if you have everything turned on in all axes and you start to pan the camera, there's a bit of a lag. The camera actually wants to stay put where it is, and it takes a moment for it to believe that you actually do want to move the camera. So that's something you have to get used to. But let me ask you this. With the Sony A7 Mark II, which has also in-body image stabilization, when I put third-party lenses on, those that need an adapter and are purely manual, I have to go into the back of the camera, into the menus, and tell the camera what the focal length is of the lens I'm using. Do you have to do that with this camera if you use a third-party lens?
Yes, you do. There is a menu. You can either get it to auto-detect the focal length, which it will if you're mounting a Micro Four Thirds or a Four Thirds lens with an adapter. But if you're putting on, you know, like a Nikkor 50mm or something like that, yes, you will. Or a Samyang lens, for example. This is a good case in point. I have a Samyang fisheye lens, which doesn't give that information out. Even though it is a native Micro Four Thirds lens, it doesn't give that EXIF information. So the camera doesn't know what to do with it, but it has other problems because it's a fisheye lens and the stabilization doesn't work that well with it anyway. So, funny example, you do need to enter it for older lenses. I'm glad you did bring up the Sony A7 Mark II, though. I reviewed that camera, and while I'm impressed, obviously, that they managed to fit stabilization on a full-frame sensor in that tiny body, for me, it was nowhere near as effective as the stabilization in the Olympus. I, in my own tests, got about 2 stops of compensation out of it, 3 at best, 2 with... Now, all of the axes don't work when you're mounting an older lens as well, so I tried it with some Canon lenses, and then I only was getting 2 stops of compensation. Better than nothing, and of course, the flip side is the sensor is 4 times the surface area of Micro Four Thirds, So you can use much higher ISOs with the same degree of noise. But when we're just talking about the actual physical compensation, I did not find the Sony system as effective as the Olympus system.
Would you say that this Olympus image stabilization is the best? Are there other cameras that have image stabilization either in the lens or in the body that's as good as this?
It's the best I've used, definitely, hands down. Some modern lenses have got amazing optical stabilization, but five stops, some lenses claim it, but really it's the best experience I've had so far with stabilization.
So one thing that it may be obvious, but I think it's worth explaining here, is people say, oh, that's great. I can, as you say, not use high ISOs. I can use longer exposures. I'm increasing the usefulness of my camera by some number of f-stops. But one thing to consider is that this is only when your subject isn't moving or when you want the motion blur. Because if you're shooting anything that's moving, this actually, you know, does you no good whatsoever.
No.
Or very, very little, let's say. Certainly not in terms of using longer and longer shutter speeds.
Yeah, definitely. Let's say you're shooting indoor sports or sports at night. Very, very challenging environment because it's low light, so you need high ISOs, and you need that high ISO to achieve a fast enough shutter speed to freeze the action. So no amount of stabilization is going to help you there because you need that fast shutter speed. And in fact, it's probably also worth mentioning that that is also probably the Achilles heel of this system anyway, in that while continuous autofocus is getting better on some mirrorless systems, in particular the Sony A6000 does it brilliantly, and the Fuji X-T1 does it very well in the middle, Olympus are still struggling with it a bit in my experience. I found that the EM5 Mark II was not great at tracking moving subjects, so I would not use it as a sports camera. It's a bit of a shame in a way because it will fire off a lot of frames per second, which is fine if your action is, say, a skateboarder or a snowboarder doing a trick in front of you. They're not really moving towards or away from you, so it's not an autofocus issue. Then it's fine. But if you need to track, say, a football player running towards you or away from you at speed, this is not the ideal system to use. Right. Not yet, anyway.
So we've put off to near the end here one of the most interesting things about this camera, one of the things that makes it extremely unique. It's a brand new feature that allows us to get not just a 16 megapixel image out of the Micro Four Thirds sensor, but 40 megapixels. Tell us about that.
Well, 16 megapixels is the native resolution of the sensor, and this has been the resolution that Micro Four Thirds has stayed at for some years, and it doesn't look like that's going to change anytime in the future. If they make the pixels smaller to squeeze more of them in, you're going to get worse high ISO performance. And that is already an area that lots of people criticize the format on. So Panasonic and Olympus are very conscious of that. However, they are equally conscious of other formats getting higher and higher resolution. Samsung's pushed APS-C beyond 24 megapixels. Of course, Canon's now got 50 megapixels on full frame. So they've got to find some way around this. And their way around it is, you see, this is very, very clever. What Olympus do is they look at the technology that's built into the camera, and rather than trying to invent new hardware all of the time, they'll go, well, let's look at what we've got. Can we use it to do something different? One of the things, for example, that they do, which is really neat, is their log exposures, where you can actually take a peek at the exposure as it's building. So if you've dialed in a 2-minute exposure and it was actually going to be overexposed after 20 seconds, that's okay, because you can actually check it every 10 seconds. And when it looks fine, you say, right, stop the exposure. You know, I don't want to go any further. And this is a similar way of thinking to what they've done with the 40 megapixel mode. They've gone, right, wait a minute, we've got a sensor mounted on a platform that can now move with the new model in extremely fine increments. We can control absolutely where this sensor is, what it can do. At the moment, we're only using it for stabilization, but can we do anything else with it? And Hasselblad actually came up with an idea on one of their medium format cameras a while ago, where they shifted the sensor. So it would take a photo, it would shift the sensor a little bit, take another one, shift it again, take another one, and slowly build up a higher resolution image. Now, this took a long time, and it was a studio-based thing only, but now Olympus have got this facility built into the EM5 Mark II. In the 40 megapixel mode, it takes 8 exposures and combines them into one. The longest exposure you can do is only a few seconds. If you're using, so it's not ideal for long exposure work, if you're using a more typical daytime type shutter speed, you know, say 60th or 125th of a second, the entire process takes about 1 second to capture these 8 images. And then the camera goes away, and assembles them. Now, what it does for these eight pictures, the thing that makes them different, is it shifts the sensor around in a square shape. So if you imagine what it does, first of all, it takes one picture, then let's say, for the sake of argument, it shifts half a pixel to the right, takes another picture, shifts another half pixel to the right. So it's now moved a whole pixel's worth. Then it takes a picture, now it goes up half a pixel, takes another one, goes up another half pixel, so now it's another whole pixel away, and it repeats this eight times. So it's got four pictures and then four kind of sub-pictures in between, if you kind of understand where I'm getting with that. I've explained it in much more detail at CameraLabs.com in the review if you want to check that out. Now, this allows it to do two things. The first thing is that almost all digital cameras use sensors with a color filter array color on every pixel. So what every pixel has is a colored filter in front of it. So when it says it's got 16 megapixels or 16 million pixels on it, each pixel is only recording one color. Typically, you have an arrangement of red, green, blue in a square. Green twice because it's their favorite color. Everyone loves green. That's a more technical reason, but you know what it is. Now, the problem with this is that when the camera, and that's actually what the RAW file records. So when you convert a RAW file, either in the camera into a JPEG or using Lightroom or Photoshop, it has to demosaic that information and create a full color picture. And if you have very fine detail, like a railing or something in the distance or roof tiles, you can get a moiré effect because it's not actually recording sufficient color detail. Now, Fovion got around that with their sensor, that Sigma bought, where it does record full color on every pixel. But what Olympus has cleverly done here with the 40 megapixel mode, this is the lesser mentioned benefit, is that by shifting a whole pixel to the side and then up and back and down again, it is effectively recording full color at every of those 16 megapixels. So the first benefit is that you can generate a 16 megapixel file without any color moiré. And believe me, they do look better. But remember those other increments that it made, those half pixel ones. It's taking a picture there, and that allows it to actually generate a picture with potentially four times as much detail. 16 megapixels, so that's 16, 32, 48, 64 megapixels worth of data. But wait a minute, it's a 40 megapixel mode. What's going on? And this was the reasoning of the Olympus engineers. Now, if you record in this mode in RAW, and there's a different menu for this, which is a bit confusing the first time you pick it up. You think you've got it set to, say, JPEG and RAW, but there's a different menu for this 40 megapixel mode, so you have to set the quality differently on it, which is a bit confusing. And also the delay or timers are a bit different on it too. What it does, the RAW file contains 64 megapixels, but Olympus thinks you're not going to get 64 megapixels worth of information. You're only going to get about 40 megapixels worth. So when it generates a JPEG, it does it in 40 megapixels. Okay, so obviously you've all been thinking, I can see it in your face, Doug. You've realized what the flaw is in this whole problem, because I mentioned it ages ago. The capture process takes 1 second at typical shutter speeds. So what if the subject moves during that time? Well, when it combines them, anything that moves is shown in a kind of ghostly, spooky way. And again, I was so fascinated by this mode. I made 15 comparisons at CameraLabs, 15 comparisons of a 16 megapixel version and a 40 megapixel version. And I shot everything. First, now Olympus are not, they're very careful to manage expectations on this. And I hope that retailers are as well. I hope that this is not advertised as a 40 megapixel camera, because it is not. It is a 16 megapixel camera with a neat trick that allows it to generate a 40 megapixel file, but with caveats. If there is motion during the capture, you will see it ghostly images. I pointed it at rivers and ducks just floating along a river. You'll see them eight times, birds flying through the sky. At this point, you begin to notice that everything moves. Trees move, even in very, very light breeze. The branches move, the leaves move. You begin to notice that every building has awnings and flags all moving during that 1 second capture process, constantly moving. Those bits look bizarre. And the surface of water, at first I thought, ooh, because I'm quite into long exposure photography, maybe it'll blur really nicely. It doesn't. It looks bizarre, and you get weird cross-hatching patterns on it. That's the bad side. The good side is that if the subject is completely still, like a building, maybe an interior of a building, or as Olympus are trying to push it, which is for studio work, maybe of still life, product photography, that sort of thing. If the subject doesn't move, then it really does generate a higher resolution image with more detail. Now, there's one other caveat. The lens needs to be very, very good quality. And beyond that, you need to have it at an optimal aperture. As you know, diffraction, which is where softening can occur on the image at small apertures, when that kicks in on micro four thirds, which it does maybe f4, f5.6, beyond that, that diffraction is already kicking in at 16 megapixels. So what do you think it's doing at 40 megapixels? There's no detail there. You will not get 40 megapixels worth of detail. You need to shoot with those lenses at f4 as a minimum, ideally f2.8, which means using a high quality lens that performs well at f2.8. So you've got to really, and this isn't just going to affect Olympus, because I think when people start, I found this with the Nikon D800, the 36 megapixel when it first came out. I shot with that alongside the 5D Mark III, which was 20-something. And when I was shooting handheld casually with the D800, my pictures contain no more detail than the 5D Mark III. They only contain more detail when I had it mounted on a tripod with a decent lens at an optimal aperture, and I was shooting almost like I was shooting medium format. I was shooting very carefully. Then and only then did I see the benefit of the detail. And that's the same thing with this. A little icon flashes if you're trying to handhold the camera and it says, no, you're not allowed to do that. You can if you want. It's not going to work. I tried. It doesn't work. Of course, it doesn't work. The stabilization sadly is disabled during the process, although they reckon in a future model they might be able to do stabilization with it or speed up the process. As it stands, it is a tripod-based solution, and you really need the subject to be steady.
But it sounds like it has to be steady, not just in terms of landscape steady, because even as you say, if the leaves are moving in the wind even slightly, and those leaves move, you know, a pixel or two, you're going to see that softening or strange effect that you're getting, right?
Yeah, you see it on that. Your people, which you didn't think were moving, are moving. Cars, which you weren't aware of in the scene, are moving. Aeroplanes are moving. Everything's moving. Even to try and avoid this, I took a picture in Prague with the 75mm 1.8, which is one of Olympus's best lenses. That can really see the benefit of this mode, so long as you don't close it much beyond 2.8. So I did a nice tight view of a building with no cars, no people, no one opening any windows, and I thought, this is going to be great. Stick it on a tripod, use the self-timer, you know, use a delay, because you can't be pressing that shutter release either. You need to use a delay, effectively a mirror lockup. There is no mirror, but you know what I mean, an anti-shock delay, to take the picture. And then I noticed when I looked at it that there were roof tilers on there moving like people do, moving their tiles. And that bit looked bizarre. And you kind of get to a point where you're like, oh, I don't know, okay, is this actually practical or not? And the Olympus again say, well, we never said you should use it outside. You should use it in the studio with still product photography, maybe car photography in the studio. But you can use it for some landscapes, so long as it's very still and you're careful. I see an opportunity to maybe do a composite where you will do a 40 megapixel and a single frame. And in fact, when you shoot RAW, it does save the first frame as a separate file. And I think with this in mind, that maybe you could combine the exposures. You could combine, say, the roofing and the tiles and the, you know, antennas and stuff like that, where you've got all that real fine detail. And then when you've got any motion, you could just paste in something from the 16 megapixel version. Might require a bit of effort, might be a bit impractical, but it's a fascinating way to boost the resolution of this camera, but they really need to manage the expectations of it.
Now, I think, you know, when Hasselblad developed this, it made really good sense for them, because their cameras are so often used for product photography or other things that literally don't move at all. Here, it's only usable in such limited cases relative to the wide range of cases that the camera is otherwise able to use. Doesn't it border a bit on being a gimmick? Isn't it sort of, you know, like you said, they did it because they could?
I think there is definitely an aspect of that, and it is slightly dangerous than putting it in, because I know that lots of people who buy this camera are going to try it out and be disappointed with it, and maybe use it on an important shoot. Maybe they go to the Grand Canyon for the first and only time in their life, or shoot a wedding, shoot a portrait with it or something, and then they look at their pictures and they go, oh no, this looks terrible, I'm really disappointed with this technology. So they have hidden it away. It is quite hard to activate it. But for enthusiasts who really understand it, I think it's a really nice thing to have. What I would recommend people do, which is what I did when I was shooting with the camera, was take two versions. You know, take a normal single frame and then do one with a 40 megapixel. And if it looks better, great, use it. If it doesn't, stick with the old one. And to be honest, I have to say that I've been using Micro Four Thirds, Olympus and Panasonic bodies for my own personal work for years now. And I've never once, when I've shown people the pictures, never once does someone go, great picture, Gordon, shame it doesn't have more resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No one ever says that. Have you noticed that?
No.
It never happens. So 60 megapixels for me is enough. And same with the Fujifilm X series. That's not that high resolution, but the images look fantastic. I am perfectly satisfied with it. But equally, I know there is a numbers game and people are playing those higher megapixel counts. So I'm really pleased that they've started the ball rolling. And you can bet that they are trying their hardest to do a handheld version of this. And also a version that captures it faster. Now, the camera's shooting at approximately 8 frames per second, approximately. So it cannot capture those 8 frames any faster than that. But if they could speed it up, or maybe do fewer frames, I said, is it possible to just do a 4-frame version? Sadly, I believe that is actually copyrighted, and they can't without paying a hefty license fee to someone. Mm. So that's one of the reasons they did an eight image version. But maybe there are ways they can speed it up, which would make it more usable. But I'm excited to have it there.
Yeah.
I'm excited to have it there.
You know,
but when you've got that, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, your thing about the megapixel wars is so true. My go-to camera, my favorite digital camera here is the Sony A7S, which is only 12 megapixels. And I've never once taken a photograph with that camera and wished that I had more resolution. Not once.
Exactly.
It's just fine. Now, you know, I want to mention briefly, I don't want to go too deep into this because of time here, but this is such a critical thing, this question about diffraction. I'll tell a little story here. A couple of years ago, when I was reviewing my first Micro Four Thirds camera, I went out and shoot a shot with it. I came back, looked at the images in Lightroom. I was horribly disappointed at how soft they were. I couldn't figure out what it was. And I contacted you, and you said, well, what aperture were you using? And I said, well, probably f11. Mm. And you said, Doug, why don't you try shooting wide open or closer to it? The diffraction is your problem. I said, really? And so I scratched my head and I went online and I studied this, and lo and behold, just like you said, you know, diffraction is really, it's not a matter of lens quality. It's an issue of physics that's related directly between the pixel pitch, the spacing or the size of the pixels relative to the aperture of the lens. And there's nothing that you can do other than, you know, other, you know, gimmicks to get around it. But this is something that I think particularly with Micro Four Thirds people have to watch out for, which is, you know, if you're shooting up in the, certainly if you're up in the F11, F16 range, you're going to see quite a bit of softening in your images. Very obvious. And so I think a lot of people realize they have to shoot certainly more towards wide open.
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is that even if you're coming from full frame or from film, there was always this kind of perception that F8 was the sweet spot for the quality of the lens. But F8 on Micro Four Thirds is already into diffraction, and you will notice it. F5.6 is still normally okay. F4, if you're dealing with a good quality lens, say that's at F1.8 or F2.8 aperture, F4 is normally the optimal setting, I find, on most of the Micro Four Thirds primes. And in terms of equivalent depth of field, not in terms of exposure, it's very important to notice those differences. In terms of equivalent depth of field, you've got that 2x factor as well compared to full frame. So F4 on Micro Four Thirds in terms of depth of field is like F8 on full frame. So you've got to ask yourself, why would you want to close, once you understand this, why would you want to close the lens to F8, 11 or 16 or 22 anyway on Micro Four Thirds? It'll kill the quality in terms of diffraction. You've got loads of depth of field already, so you're not doing it for that. The only reason you do it is to reduce the amount of light getting into the camera for some long exposure effect. And that's quite an interesting one, because the base ISO on these cameras is 200 ISO. Now, there is a low setting, which is 100 ISO, but when you go below that base setting, you are going to lose a little bit of dynamic range. So this is a bit of a problem, but if you're using neutral density filters, it isn't. I did want to say before we wrap up, Doug, there's a few other little things that make this camera a lot better than its predecessor, which were inherited from the EM1. First is a faster shutter speed, 1/8th of a second using the mechanical shutter compared to 1/4th. Very important if you've got a nice bright prime and you're shooting in daylight. 1/4th, you often bump up against that at f1.8, especially if you're shooting at 200 ISO and not 100. What the EM5 Mark II has that neither of its predecessors had, the EM1 or the Mark I, is an electronic shutter. Now, electronic shutters operate in complete silence. So this becomes a fantastic street camera because you can press the shutter and there's no sound at all. I should actually say that even the mechanical shutter is quieter than before. It's a very, very quiet mechanical shutter, but if you choose the electronic shutter, it's completely silent. There can be some rolling shutter artifacts when you're shooting with the electronic shutter, but at least you've got that option. When you're in a church, at a wedding or something, or in a library, so nice to be able to shoot without any noise. The viewfinder is inherited from the EM1, so it's got XGA resolution instead of SVGA. So it's much bigger than before. It's identical to the EM1. It has the Wi-Fi of the EM1 as well, so which was lacking on the original EM5. You could put an iFi card in it, but it's not the same as having it integrated if you want to do remote control with your smartphone. So all these little usability upgrades, even though, let's forget about the 40 megapixel mode, let's pretend that doesn't exist. If you're just judging the 16 megapixel images, it is not a big step up in quality from an EM1. It's essentially the same quality as an EM1, even though it is a different sensor. But the amount of things they've added to it and the way they've improved the handling and the usability of it, I mean, for me, it turned into probably the most satisfying camera, all-round camera, that I've used in a long time. And I would be very, very, very happy to use it day to day. Not for sports, not when people are running towards or away from me. I go over to my Sony A6000 for that. But for everything else, I really, really like this camera.
Yeah. So we've compared it to the old EM5. We've compared it to the EM1. The other manufacturer in the Micro Four Thirds world is Panasonic with their Lumix line. Is there a Lumix camera that you would compare to this one? And would you compare it favorably or not so favorably?
I talked to Panasonic about this quite a lot. Their flagship model is the GH4. Which doesn't really go up against the EM5 Mark II. It's more expensive. It does have an excellent viewfinder, fully articulated screen. It doesn't have built-in stabilization. The thing it does do is record 4K in camera, and it does it very, very well. It also does 1080p at, I think, 96 frames per second, certainly enough to do a significant slowdown on it, which is really nice. So the GH4 is all about video, really. It's a nice stills camera, but it's quite expensive for a stills camera. So that's at a higher level. The next model down from Panasonic at the moment is the aging GX7, which did have built-in stabilization, but it was their first attempt at it, and in my test, it wasn't very good at it. I also didn't like that it had a wide-shaped viewfinder image. Great if you're filming video, bit annoying if you're shooting stills. It's the wrong shape for stills, and I think that camera is a stills camera, not a video camera. It also used a technology on the viewfinder that produce little rainbow artifacts for me. Not everyone can see these. It affects some people more than others. But when you glance over the image, it kind of broke up a bit for me, whereas the OLED finders that Olympus use and that Panasonic uses in the GH4, they look better to me. So they've kind of got one camera that's higher and one that's lower that's getting on a bit. So I would say the sensible money, if you're a betting man or woman, would be that Panasonic have got a gap, certainly an opportunity to upgrade the GX7. But it's very, very hard to beat this because Olympus has had a lot of experience with the built-in stabilization. And it's just so good on the EM5 Mark II. I cannot imagine anybody getting to that level in their next generation. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. If Panasonic could achieve the same degree of stabilization and deliver 4K in camera, brilliant.
But I
suspect they'll always be that different.
It's, you know, this is technically, this is, as we've said, Olympus's second tier camera in the line. But everything you've said and what I've read on CameraLabs.com gives me the impression that this is actually your favorite of all the Micro Four Thirds cameras you shot with.
Yeah, so I'm holding the EM1 here, which is still the flagship model. Why would you buy the EM1 instead of the EM5 Mark II? Well, there are a few benefits to this model. The first is that it's obviously a bit bigger. It's got a comfortably bigger grip and even chunkier control. So it is a more comfortable camera to use. Even if you've got small hands like me, the EM1 is a more comfortable camera, although I'm happy to trade that for the other benefits of the EM5 Mark II. This camera, Olympus recently delivered a firmware update that allows it to offer continuous autofocus at 9 frames per second, whereas on the EM5 Mark II, it will only offer continuous autofocus at 5 frames per second. However, now I should say I have not tested this capability on the EM1 yet. I will be, but I haven't done it yet. But in my experience, their continuous AF tracking has never been that compelling. So I'd be surprised, relieved, and delighted, but surprised if they've resolved it. They might have done. I've not tested it. I will soon, and we'll do an update. What this camera does have is phase detect AF built into the sensor that is for use with older four-thirds lenses. If you came from, say, an E3, one of their DSLRs, and you've got a collection of the old four-thirds lenses, they will focus much faster and better with the EM1 than the EM5 Mark II. But you know, I don't know a single person who has any of those lenses. And even on the EM1, I would hardly describe them as a fast focusing experience. It's something to tide you by until you can replace it with a native Micro Four Thirds lens. One of the really big differences I noticed was in the buffer when you're doing continuous shooting. This, on the EM1, you can just keep taking pictures for ages and ages and ages. It's like a kind of, it's not quite up to a 7D Mark II from Canon, but it's that sort of thing. You can do very long bursts. On the EM5 Mark II, the bursts are much shorter. But again, I don't see it as an action camera, either of them as an action camera. So once you've kind of ruled all that out, the main difference, if you don't have four-thirds lenses, and if you've accepted that it's not going to be great at continuous AF, is the physical shape of it. And the EM1 is a really nice shape, and it's very, very comfortable to hold. But I prefer having the fully articulated screen, the 40-megapixel mode, even though it's a bit of a novelty, and the other benefits of the EM5 Mark II, its size as well. And it's an absolute charmer. I'm going to show it here with the Olympus 17mm, which is equivalent, of course, to 34. This is a great general-purpose lens. I know that you've got it there, Doug, with some bigger lenses. It loses a lot of the charm. I should also say, if you are going to be shooting with the big lenses, the EM5 Mark II is going to feel a little bit small without the grip. But with these little lenses, this just becomes such a compact camera to use. I've got a photo of it at the top of my review, maybe on the verdict page, next to a cup of coffee. And it's not a giant cup of coffee. It's not a comedy cup of coffee. It's not a crazy prop. It just looks really nice. And also in silver, I never really liked their silver bodies, but with the silver lens, I think it looks really smart.
Yeah, it's a nice camera, no doubt about it. Well, Gordon, I want to thank you and congratulate you on your first episode here on All About the Gear. And this will be our new format moving forward. I look forward to getting feedback from all our viewers and listeners. Tell us what you like, and even more important, tell us what you didn't like about this show.
We didn't like Lane. Get rid of Lane. Bring back Van Johnson.
The easiest way is to send us a comment through thisweekinphoto.com. You'll find us there. I think you can go to thisweekinphoto.com/gear. I'm not sure if that URL works or not. Again, remember, if you want even more detail, always go to cameralabs.com. You'll find far more than you could ever possibly consume. Get a glass of wine or your favorite beer.
You'll need one, definitely.
You'll need one. In fact, it'll probably be two beers to get through the articles. Also, if you're interested in purchasing this gear or any gear, I encourage you to go to cameralabs.com and click on the links there. It helps Gordon pay the bills, and he won't pimp it that way, but I have no problem begging for money on his behalf. So please go to cameralabs.com. Check out more of Gordon's terrific reviews and come back next time for another episode of All About the Gear. Gordon, thank you very much. It was a terrific first episode.
Thank you, Doug. I really enjoyed it. I look forward to number 2.
We'll do it. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.